Have we heard from Demetrius at all? Okay. All right, well, we have a quorum, and I will call this meeting of the Minnesota League of Cities to order on January 23rd at 9:33. Would everyone please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Our first order of business is approval of two sets of minutes, the November 7th regular meeting and our special meeting of December 12th. Are there any questions or changes? Yes.
On page 2 of November 7 minutes, I am actually Ward 4 in the city of Bradenton.
Okay.
So minor correction.
All right. If we will note under item 6B, that is corrected to Ward 4. And hearing no other corrections or changes, do I have a motion?
Move approval.
Okay.
Second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All right. So our truly first order of business is a special presentation by Florida Power and Light, and I am divided. Devaney, I'm going to let you introduce everyone that is here with you, because I'll either miss someone or mispronounce a few names. So thank you all for coming on this glorious sunny day on Lonoke Key. We're delighted you're here.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all for being here. So for those that don't know me, my name is Devaney Iglesias. So I am the External Affairs Regional Manager for Florida Power and Light Company. When Gail reached out and asked for us to attend today, majority of the questions she submitted to me that came from some of your members primarily were around undergrounding, wanting to understand that process better. But I wanted to be overly prepared. I know it was a very busy storm season, and I know that there are probably a lot of questions. So in addition to my Storm Secure Underground team, I also invited several other members of my team to make sure all bases were covered and we would be prepared to answer any questions that may come up from all of you. So I'll invite Leslie up. She'll be doing the presentation, but in the room as well, we have Michael, we have Troy, we have Hal, and we have Steven. All members of various departments within our company, and again, all related to power delivery and can answer any of those questions. So with that, I'll hand it over to Leslie.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Leslie.
Hello, good morning, everybody. Like you said, my name is Leslie Cleaver.
And just to give you a heads up, you have to keep that microphone pulled almost to your mouth or else we only hear part of it.
Is that better? Closer?
Good.
Okay.
No.
Or I can project. I'm also good.
Projecting's good too.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Leslie Cleaver. I'm the Lateral Hardening Manager for the Storm Secure Underground Program. And this is just a brief overview of kind of what we do and why we do it. So in past hurricanes, we found that vegetation was the leading cause of outages for laterals in our system. I don't know if you can see the photos here. I don't know if you have them in front of you.
We all have screens in front of us.
Wonderful. All right, so if you look really closely in all of these photos, you'll see that those trees are actually taking down the power lines with them. Right? So since vegetation was the leading cause, where do you not find vegetation? In the ground. So we decided to start the program to underground our power lines or harden our laterals. So what are laterals? Right? If you're not in the power delivery business, that may be not something that you know. So our system is broken down into three main categories. So you have the transmissions, you know, you have those big 500 kV lines that run down, you know, the turnpike or any of those big roads. And then you have distribution feeder lines. Those are going to be the lines on your main thoroughfare. Those two types of lines are not handled by our program. We handle lateral lines. On the far right, you'll see those. Those are the ones that you're going to see in neighborhoods. They stem off the distribution feeder lines. So you'll have feeder lines kind of like your backbone, and then your laterals are kind of like your ribs coming off of that. All right, so this is generally what most of our residential customers are fed off of. Not always, but generally so. All right, so how do underground power lines benefit our customers? So we have found that underground power generally performs 50% better in day-to-day operations. That's your blue sky every day, not in a storm kind of weather. We also find that it speeds our restoration efforts in a case of a hurricane or other such events, and it reduces the interruptions caused by vegetation. So 2024 was a historic hurricane season. It was the first time since 1871 that we have experienced six hurricanes have landfall in Florida in the same year. But we did have some developments that did help customers stay in power longer. So we have smart grid technology that helped avoid about 824,000 outages in those three storms. And then we found that in all those three storms last year, our underground power lines performed 5 to 14 times better throughout the system overall, okay? And then we have stronger infrastructure. So we're hardening those feeder line poles with concrete poles and those transmission with concrete poles. All right, so how does the Storm Secure Underground program select which laterals we're gonna underground? And how do we prioritize? So what we look at are three main criteria, which is driven by, it's data driven. So there's no way to move up the list. So there's performance during previous named storms. There are outages due to vegetation and day-to-day performance reliability. All that information is run through a system and it gives us our priority of what we want to underground first. Now this is reran every single year because every year we have new data that we have to include in our calculations. Our program also has criteria to approve to harden overhead. So what we're looking at if we're going to harden a system overhead rather than undergrounding is going to be that there were low to no vegetation outages over the last 10 years. We're going to look at the conditions. Is it in a swamp? Is it in wetlands, forests, areas prone to flooding, farms? We're also going to make sure that there's no critical infrastructure customers on there. And we're going to look at our ability to get easements because we have to have a place to install our equipment. And we're also going to look at congestion. Do we actually have the space to build what we're looking to do? Now, what does work look like on the West Coast over the next couple of years? So in Manatee and Sarasota counties, we have a couple of different projects that we're looking to get underway, and they're in various phases. So the majority of these are in the design phase, but we do have one that is finishing up construction. Overall, we're looking to underground about 86.9 miles, which represents around 9,600 customers. And that's all I have in case you have questions. I do want to make sure you guys do know the contacts for my team. So on my Storm Secure Underground team with us today, you have Michael Flowers over, raise your hand, right? And you also have Troy Todd. So they are representing the Storm Secure Underground team for the West Coast.
Questions, please, for Leslie. Lisa?
Yes. I noticed on the list of upcoming projects, the only one in Manatee County is in Palmetto. How are you, from a regional aspect, using that data? Are you looking by municipality, or is it truly just across your entire region to prioritize because it seems heavy?
It's completely data-driven, right? So we take those three criteria that we talked about, so outages during past named storm events, outages due to vegetation, and day-to-day reliability. We take that data and we just figure out what's at the top of the list of what could most benefit from undergrounding. And that's how we do it. We don't look at where, what municipalities it's in, right? It's just purely data.
Is it somehow like the consumer, like in, I mean, I guess is that data readily available to us? And I guess my question is, I mean, you're saying that it's data driven, but mm-hmm. are we considering, I mean, I guess when you go through approximate customers,
Are you saying that it's because there's larger amount of customers in Sarasota County that it seems like they're?
It's just the laterals on those feeder strength tire.
I'm sorry, the laterals what?
The laterals on those feeder names, right? They ranked higher.
When she says.
And when she says ranked higher, I also want to clarify. So it's worse performing. So we look at everything from an ops perspective as well. So if we're sending out crews multiple times a year to fix specific lines, fixing that becomes a priority because that's going to be less ops costs for us, ultimately lowering our costs and making sure that we can keep our bills relatively stable and low for our customers. And we're trying to take that piece out of the equation by making our grid as efficient as possible. So we attack those worst performing lines first, and then basically go from there. And the other thing I don't know if you want to talk about as well is, as she said, we run this report every year. Mm-hmm. So these are in design and construction for, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the next like 2 year window. And then you can talk a little bit about timing.
Yeah, so it's in design and construction, which is a multi-year process. Right between by the time we go out and we start our initial designs, we get easements from customers. You know, we do outreach to the municipalities or the counties that are affected, and then we get our permits and construct. It is a multi-year process.
Yes, Terry. Oh, just Terry.
Terry's fine.
Okay.
I think, and Debbie's here. Can answer this probably as well as anyone. How did the underground system in Bradenton Beach hold up?
I don't have that level of detail. All I have right now is that overall throughout the whole state in those three storms, it performed 5 to 14 times better.
Debbie, I had heard, and I think wrongfully, that there was a lot of disruption because the underground system was so new at the time that there was a lot of washout and a loss of transmission. Perhaps that's not true.
Yeah, I don't think our undergrounding is that far along, honestly, because we are in the process of working with FDOT and FPNL, as I understand, because of the new Cortez Bridge, and we're still kind of struggling with undergrounding. So that's why I'm very interested in what's being said here, because I think I have mixed signals on that.
Okay, yeah, I heard wrong. Is your presentation, Gail, is this a presentation you can send to us by email, or is there paper copies of this that we can take back for our staff?
It's being recorded.
Recorded. Okay. So available.
Yeah, we should be able to.
Okay. Good.
Jen?
Good.
Just real quick to add to your comment, Barry, there. On day-to-day afternoon storms, the underground does perform much better. And even, you know, we've seen the past three storms this past year, you know, they were all different. You had Debbie roll in and Helene were both water event. Debbie was freshwater event, which it performed well. The underground system did perform well, especially out of the eastern sections there. Helene was more of a salt water. We had all the sand and stuff. That was the washout was from the sand. So on a day-to-day basis, even on a hurricane basis, when it's a wind event, the underground is performing better. Like I said, now with the tidal we had and just all that sand and that was a different story. We want to say with the underground here, but you know, we are now after that storm looking at what we could do. You know, after, you know, BJ, you've seen it before the years. We raised all the pads. We're going raising those pads there, working with House and those team on that as well, looking at that. And we're also looking, what else can we do? We have gone out and inspected most of the transformers on Longboat Key now. We have a program now we've learned after this storm to go out there after the storm and inspect to see where the deterioration is, and if we're changing them out, you know, if they're bad enough, we are changing them out proactively on those as well.
We just approved in Tuesday's budget discussions, there's the opportunity to take those transformers and literally raise them up in the air because we did have so many transformers fail with the saltwater. Saltwater and power just are really unhappy partners, and we have some areas that we are, correct me if I'm wrong, we are totally serviced underground. We're just waiting for poles and wires to come down, and there's, I knew you were going to jump up. They're really sick of seeing me on this issue.
Good morning. My name is Hal Tran. I'm the program manager for the Overhead Underground municipal program that Lombo Key and parts of Bradenton Beach have gone through. The update for Lombo Key, there is one phase that they're currently performing the service conversions. That is planned to be completed by the end of the month here. And at that point, all the customers on Lombo Key will be served with the new underground system. And then we'll be starting to remove the poles currently. So we are in the process of removing some of those poles. We've removed the very south end at phase one, the very north end at phase two. Then jumping back to the north side of phase one, those poles are being removed currently. So once the services are all converted in phase four, we'll de-energize the overhead lines and start and continue removing those poles until they're all gone. So,
and do we have any estimation of when, because unfortunately the public only sees poles. They right. have no understanding that it's really working underground. Do we know when we will be finished?
Yeah, right now they're in phase three. Actually, we're a little bit delayed with, I believe it's either Comcast or AT&T. They missed a certain section out there, which kind of delayed us a little bit. But I would expect for at least for phase three in the next 2 months, we should be completely out of phase three. And then phase four, as soon as the underground conversions are complete, we'll start there. So it'll probably take another 2.5, 3 months for phase four. And then we should be completely done with Lombo Key.
So if I said June 30th, would I be safe?
June 30th, we should be pretty close to that.
Okay.
Yeah, we should be pretty close to that.
Devaney will warn you. I'll be calm. Nick, did I see your? Oh, Terry, did you?
If I could just follow up, if I understood you properly, the initiative to consider going underground in any municipality is based on FPL's record of loss of transmission, or is there a collaboration with a city requesting a study to determine whether at its discretion it would like for you to pursue underground
yeah,
service?
So,
and the reason I ask that is I don't think your records, we haven't had a surge from Holmes Beach on Anna Maria. We haven't had a surge anywhere close to this in the past. That's going to certainly change the loss of transmission. And my question then, a follow-up to that is, will there be further consideration of the other barrier reef islands, Anna Maria in particular, for consideration? Obviously, it's already initiated in Bradenton Beach, but do the cities play any role in addressing Florida Power and request a study to determine feasibility?
Yeah, so I just want to make sure that we're clear. We're talking about two different programs, right? The program that I oversee is the municipal-driven, where you know the cities and towns reach out to FPL and wanting to see the feasibility of undergrounding.
Okay.
The SSUP program is purely data-driven and is initiated on the FPL side. So it's not that you know if cities reach out to you know FPL and start this conversation that we feed this information over to SSUP. That's there's a delineation there, right? We pretty much try to accomplish the same thing, but it's two different ways about doing so, right? So the my program that I oversee is requested by the towns and cities, and then we go through that you know that process, and there's a contribution from the towns and cities to help with the construction and the design and construction of these projects. On the SSUP side, those are driven by the data, as Leslie said. And you know, if you take, you know, that we don't actually look at the towns and cities where they're at, you know, geographically. Besides saying it's the West region, anywhere from you know north of the Manatee port, all the way down to City of Naples, right? And those are all put in, the data is put in, and you know we don't look at towns and cities, just wherever those laterals fall on those feeders and how they rank. It may look like Sarasota is getting the brunt of the work here, and there's no bias here, right? I mean, this is just data that's driven there. Sarasota, you know, they got a lot of old areas there, rear of lines, like trees that have been growing through many of the years that they've been there, and that's probably what you're seeing here, is what's reflected. But as far as my program here, you know, this, any city can request any ballpark estimates. We don't charge for ballpark estimates. It typically takes a couple weeks to get that back. But it gives you an idea of what the FPL cost would be. But as part of my program, we do require that all the utilities are underground and that are attached to our poles so we can remove the poles completely, whether that be cable, telephone, any other third-party attachments that are on the poles. We do require those to be undergrounded as well.
And to conduct that study, who's the contact person?
Yeah, so you can either reach out to myself directly or Debbie, and she'll get the information over to me. Yeah, so again, like I mentioned, we do require the other third-party attachments to be converted as well, but we don't necessarily do that coordination. It would be the town's responsibility to kind of head that up.
Thank you.
I have a lot of questions.
Okay. Anybody else have a few questions? Because Jen has a lot. All right.
Okay. So, you had mentioned that there are two ways of going about doing this. One is municipal-driven with a contribution from the city. Does that mean FPL makes some sort of a contribution as well, or is it only on the city to fund this effort?
So we go through, it's a tariff. It's a Public Service Commission, you know, tariff that we have to follow. There are certain credits that FPL will give because, you know, an underground system will perform better than an overhead system over throughout a number of years. So there's a credit for that because operating an underground system is, you know, more efficient than an overhead system. So there's certain credits, but there's, you know, the estimate for the underground, there's an estimate for the overhead, and those credits are added in. So there is a little bit of both. There's a contribution that FPL will pay on, you know, on our behalf, but then also there's a contribution from the municipal side to fund the project.
Okay, so when you said the operating underground system will perform better than an overground system, when hurricanes come through and you have the underground system versus the overground system, do you actually ever add a value to what didn't happen because it was underground? Like, do you know those numbers?
So it's a very complex, I guess, calculation they have.
Sure.
And so there's it's rated over a 30-year period, right? So they call it a net present value of the overhead system compared to the underground system and how it performs over those 30 years. The credit right now I know is, you know, that there's two credits that are combined into one. One is the avoided storm restoration costs, meaning during a storm, the cost of restoring an overhead system versus an underground system, right? And then there's the other credit is a operational, cost that is saved over those 30 years operating an underground system versus an overhead system. And combined, currently, that's about a $314,000 per mile credit for that for that credit of operating the two different systems.
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand that cost, because we all know when we have hurricanes and even before, you know, in anticipation, FPL comes in and they go to Roberts Arena and they all line up there. And when you drive by, you're just, you know, in awe of how many people it takes, how many trucks come here, what it takes to deploy. Everybody needs to eat. Everybody needs to shower. And it's just this whole massive operation. And whenever, you know, you drive, you think, what must that cost? So that savings, I think, would be, you know, is important to quantify. I wanted to understand the difference between the municipal driven and the SSUP, which I don't really know what that stands for. And when Terry was asking about how do you get on that list, and you say it's all data driven. So the city can't say, excuse me, you would have potentially saved X amount of dollars had we been underground. Can we get up on that list, or can we put our hat in the ring, or can we...
Right, so...
Do something to get on that list.
SSUP stands for Storm Secure Underground Program. The credit itself is shown in the tariff, right? And as if you ask for a ballpark estimate, we'll share what the estimated credit will be when we provide you that information to see if you want to, you know, make that decision to move forward or not. But yeah, again, like I said, it's two different programs. We just want to make sure that everybody's aware of that.
Okay.
If you know, the towns and cities are interested in getting a ballpark, that's not a problem. You can request and we can provide that at no cost.
And does FPNL offer any sort of grants for any areas? For example, in the city of Sarasota, you know, I know there are certain areas where I would like to see underground first before others. I would like to see the whole city underground, frankly, but, you know, I know it doesn't happen like that. And are there any grants or any programs where if a part of the city would like to be the municipally driven undergrounding effort, are there opportunities to apply for grants because of X, Y, and Z criteria?
There are no grants available. We've had HOAs reach out as well. It would be a similar type project, so it's municipal owned, but it's really just, I would say, large customer based owned that gets driven. That's kind of what HAL manages. If there's like a big HOA or something that's requesting that. One of the big things that I wanted to point out within this discussion of the difference between SSUP and the one that HAL manages, SSUP, keep in mind, we're a regulated utility. And so SSUP is a program that is paid for by customers, which is why it is an FPL-driven program, because it is an overall benefit to the entire electric, our entire customer base. So because we are regulated and we go through the Public Service Commission, we need to make sure that everything we're doing is fair for all customers. And so in order to look at it holistically and take costs out of the equation for us, that's why we go after this data-driven. We need to be able to make the case when we go back before the Florida Public Service Commission why we selected these specific municipalities or specific laterals that we did. It has to be data-driven in order for it to be equal to our entire customer base. And so when there is a municipality that wants to get on that list, it falls into a different bucket, because at that point we can't fund something like that and show favoritism, I guess you can say, or give one municipality a leg up versus another, right? Because at the end of the day, more than likely every municipality is wanting to go underground. So the fairest way for us to do that is to attack it from the worst performing lines, eventually get as much of our entire, and I believe it's still the mission, to our entire laterals to go underground. It's just going to take a long time to get there. So in order to, I guess, expedite that, the burden of cost ends up falling on the customer that wants to escalate that timeline.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
And so what goes in when a municipality needs to, or an area needs to figure this out about if they're going to escalate it and do it themselves and go the municipal driven, what kinds of costs do they need to take into account? How do they go ahead and figure out how they're going to assess it? You know, you had mentioned trees, you had mentioned easements, you had mentioned some things like that, but just in general, what should...
So it is a, you know, once we go through it, it is a daunting task. And it's several years. I think Lombok Key has been a bunch of years in the making. I think it dates back to 2004 is when they first requested certain ballpark estimates and such. And so there...
You might want to mention that we paid for the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, so there was quite a big contribution from the town to work the project. But as far as all the responsibilities, right, I mean, FPL will provide the estimate, will do the design. One of the main things that the town or the cities would be responsible for is obtaining the easements, obviously getting the agreements to move forward with the project, the funding, obviously, and then responsibility of converting the other utilities as well. So the same thing you're doing with FPL, you'd have to go through with the other carriers in the same process. So I know Lombok Key, City of Bradenton Beach, they've used a consultant to assist with that, a consultant that's worked across multiple projects, so they understand that, and they can provide a little more guidance on that. The only thing we can provide is what it would require for FPL, right? And so there's, you know, it's a big effort. I'm not going to say that it's going to be easy. There, you know, all the projects that have gone through the conversion process across the state has been multi-year, and it's not a very fast process. You know, there are customers out there that don't want underground, so you gotta. That's an uphill battle as well. We deal with that on SSUP and our projects here, And so it's there. We can get into more detail on that. You know, that when you request the ballpark estimate, that's when that process gets started. We'll provide that information and have those discussions.
Does it make sense that municipalities that, or does it play in your role at all if a municipality has gone the route of doing it themselves, that there's FPL puts, I know the data-driven thing, but the next contiguous area up on the list, does that play any role in it?
Purely data-driven.
So,
and that doesn't go into the data, it's contiguous and would help everybody along the way.
Come up to the mic for me so we grab this.
The selection criteria of the areas that would most benefit and are on the top of our list, it is purely data-driven on the performance of those laterals.
Just the performance of the laterals. Okay. Yep. And then one last question. I have many more, but I'll just ask one. Here I see Sarasota Ringling 61. What does that mean?
So that is the name of the substation in the feeder that has been selected for undergrounding.
How do we know what area that is?
So my team can provide you more information on that if you have a select one that you're interested in. I just don't have that with me.
I was just curious which of these that say Sarasota are in the city of Sarasota, since I represent the city.
I believe they're all Sarasota County.
They're all in the county. None of these are in the city.
Hyde Park is probably in the city. That's around the hospital.
Okay, so it'd be 33 or 38?
From the hospital.
Come up to the mic for me. Thank you.
I've got to introduce myself. I'm Stephen Norton. I'm the operation manager, and I oversee Manatee and Sarasota counties. And basically, I oversee the new construction and reliability, you know, both with there. So looking at this, Clark substation is off of Clark Road, so that might be out of the city. Hyde Park substation is around the hospital. So that's around Sarasota Memorial. So I feel that's all in the city there. Philippi substation is around Philippi Creek Elementary School.
Okay.
So, you know, that's maybe some there. And Ringling's off of 17th and Honor. So up.
Still not in the city. Honor is just, just outside the city, okay. I think.
And then South Venice, of course, is further south.
Okay.
Keep going. Where is that?
Okay. So South Venice, that's.
Those are all
Sarasota. It's Sarasota County. I'm trying to get in the area.
We need you at the mic, too, since we're going to be sending out this tape.
I'm just trying to give you exact kind of ballpark.
The South Venice ones are where 41 and 776 cuts off on the right-hand side there.
So both of those are far south.
They're they're all south. Nothing in the city.
Sorry, Nick.
And just to expound a little bit more, my name's Troy Todd. I'm the lead project manager for the West Region for the Storm Secure Underground Program. So we have projects that we have completed within the city of Sarasota, up in the Bougainvillea 41 corridor, some of those finger streets over there. And then as Stephen alluded to, the Hyde Park 33 is kind of on the border. So when we went in for permitting and everything, we had to acquire permitting from both Sarasota County as well as the city of Sarasota. So we have been in the city for a few projects.
Okay, thank you. Nick?
So as you can tell, and I just met Ebony for the first time during these last storms, we're all very curious, and our constituents are very curious about what all of this means. So, I mean, I would love to sit with somebody for just even 30 minutes to find out all of these details. I mean, see some maps, because we start learning things when we're elected that maybe the common folk don't understand. But even nowadays, it's like the cloud to me. You know, I get told, well, the grid. I don't even know what that means. You know, well, the hospitals are service first, then commercial, you know, and I start to understand these things, but trying to explain it to our constituents, spending some time with you guys to learn this is very important. So I hope you understand how valuable you being here today is to all of us, because we get asked these questions, especially with hurricane season coming around again. We're going to get asked all these. Why don't we have underground? And just sitting with your CEO, he even explained the difference between, well, underground was still 8 times more effective than overhead with the surge. So it was like, really? So it was still that much more productive to have that than it was. And Longboat was our example, because we wanted to understand how well it worked for them with the surge that they had. So just my brief statement there is that I would love to spend some time with you guys to learn more about it. And I'm glad that Jen was asking those questions, because I wanted to ask that same thing about, I don't know what 35, 31, you know, so I want to know these things so that I can explain this to people. The other thing was, who specifically requests the ballpark estimate? Is that any member of our council? Is that our city manager? Who would typically request that type of a estimate?
So I'll answer your first question and then give it back to you. But anytime you want anything FPL related, any kind of information to set up any meeting, contact me. So I'll be sure that my contact information, Gail has it, and I'll make sure that my contact information is sent out to everyone here. And please feel free to share that with the rest of your board. Most of your town managers or city managers should already have that contact information as well. But I'm your direct contact. And I'm more than happy to sit down with you and also, in layman's terms, try to explain what our electric grid is and our electric system is and how that works. I like to describe it as a road system. It's easier for people to grasp. So I'm more than happy to sit down with you. And then depending on, again, where your questions might come, I'll be responsible for coordinating to make sure we have the right people in the room to, again, make sure that all your questions are answered. I think one of the things that I've learned since being in this role and serving on this coast is FPL, you know, on the East Coast where our headquarters is and everything, visually you see how big FPL is. Over here on the West Coast, really FPL is just the people who fix your power lines and you don't see the big structure or anything. And I think people, I'll be somewhere and someone knows someone that works at FPL and they're like, oh, do you know my friend? And it's like, We are a company of 10,000 people. So we are a big company. We have a lot of different departments. And while all of these folk work, for example, in power delivery, they all do very different things. And so I want to make sure I have the right people in the room that can answer the vast majority of questions that you may have that may cross over in between different departments as well.
Well, and just learning from you guys this past go around, I mean, many of our constituents don't even realize that there's something other than FPL, that there's a Duke or a Pike.
Yep.
People don't even realize that, how much you actually service and don't service and what parts of the state. I mean,
absolutely.
Just spending 30 minutes with you guys, I've learned so much about what's behind this.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to share that with constituents, it really helps them. They want to know. They're not necessarily trying to be angry or difficult. They just want to understand,
mm-hmm.
you know, how come it takes eight days to get my power back on it. And very much like Commissioner Koch, it's like Ahern Koch. It's the same thing in that how does this work? Can we bump ourselves up on a list? I mean, people think we can. So being able to tell them, no, this is purely data driven, you know, it just helps us do our job a little bit more effectively.
Absolutely. And I will also share that the Storm Secure Underground program team is very known for going around and doing presentations to various HOAs and associations that want that information. It's just a matter of requesting it. So again, if you know of folks that are requesting it or asking for more information, please feel free to let me know and we can connect them with the right people. And then technical stuff, I'll hand over.
Gotcha. So my only question for you was more specifically, how do we get this ballpark estimate request done?
So the cities or municipalities, whoever you designate to be the point person, you can reach out to, like I said, myself directly or Devney, and we can get that process started for you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I think you mentioned like whether we can bump or be in advance when you're doing the data driven assessment, is that in the realm of possibility that a certain area actually is demoted on the list because of maybe, I don't know, another factor of another city? And the reason why I ask that question is it seems I appreciate the explanation regarding keeping the affordability across the region, but I feel like there is an element of a potential unjust situation where a specific area is continually bearing the weight of waiting in an effort to keep affordability across the board for all regional customers. And kind of piggybacking on that, if there is some, you know, bumping and demoting, what is the role that critical infrastructure type services makes, hospitals, fire stations, police stations, that sort of thing?
So we reevaluate the list every single year as we get new data, right? Because over the last year, 2024 was a big year, right? So we're going to have a whole new fresh set of data that we're going to evaluate, right? So until a feeder, all the laterals on a feeder, have been selected for undergrounding, they can move up and down the list, right? But again, it is still only based on the performance of those laterals that roll up to a feeder level basis, right? So we do, our process is we call a feeder approach or feeder methodology. You may hear us refer to it at times. In which case, what we do is we look at the performance of every single lateral that is fed by that feeder, and we underground all of those laterals at the same time, right? So that's why you may hear us say feeder or lateral, right? So we're still just undergrounding the laterals, not the feeders themselves, but we do it on a feeder level, if that makes sense to you. And generally, critical infrastructure is fed off the feeder themselves, right? And so the feeders would not be something that our program would handle.
Demetrius.
Just to add as well, the our feeders and our laterals, we don't have like a geographical boundary as far as, you know, municipalities, what they serve. They may serve multiple municipalities, right? You know, we'll have, you know, feeders up in Bradenton where they feed the mainland and then also the Barrier Island at the same time. So it's not a geographical, and it doesn't have an impact. I mean, if you removed the cities and the franchise names off of here, it would still be the same rankings, right? It's basically the bottom line.
Thank you for clarifying.
My question, well, first of all, thank you for being here. It's very informative. My question is probably going to be for Stephen. Do you have any projection for any new construction builds as a requirement to go underground? And are there any incentivized programs to do that, or discounts, or for new construction? I'm a certified builder, so that's why I'm asking. And people
for
ask
new,
me that.
New construction, most new construction, we have followed our URD tariff, which is the tariff, and as you know, most subdivisions are going underground now. And so that tariff over time takes a look at what it costs to build overhead versus underground, and it's a differential of that. You know, FPL is still an overhead provider. We're still an overhead service provider. So we look at what our cost is versus overhead versus underground. So when a developer comes to us, they have that choice to say, we want to go overhead or we want to go underground. And so that's where we look at that tariff, and that's where the bill you'll get is that tariff for saying this is where the differential is between an overhead subdivision and an underground subdivision.
Do you see some projection as a requirement to go underground? Because this would be a good investment.
At an FPL level, no, we wouldn't. We would not force that. That's more of a, it'd be a county by county ordinance or something, or a state level at one time. But that'd be more of a county thing when you're going into permitting.
Okay, but do you see? Do you offer some like discounts once they get the breakdown, or how is it? How does it?
It's all, you know, based on that tariff. Not really a discount. Okay. So that tariff costs go. Now within that tariff, they look at, you know, the storm stuff, but it's more of a just overhead versus purely underground differential.
And another question, if I may. One constituent approached me and said, in the city of Northport that I represent, are there any quality control programs connecting to underground, switching from overhead to underground? He was complaining that the quality was not as good as he expected by the subs as a FPL. FPL was not present, but the sub.
Yeah, no, they have this, the subs work, and then the subs have a supervisor report too. After they're done, there is an inspection program. They go back and through that and look. And so if he had any problems, then he could reach out, you know, either to you or subs, get the dev, or we can find out who that, you know, that is and go to speak with those subs if he's seeing something. But there is an after the job is complete, they do have an inspection program.
And that would be a regional office? Because we have
one. It would go through the Northport office, at Toledo Blade. So Toledo, I guess that is, yeah, Toledo Blade would be a different management area. There, but you can contact Debbie to get that information.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Debbie? As Terry alluded to, Bradenton Beach has undergrounding. I'm new to the commission of Bradenton Beach, so I don't have a lot of information. And what he said about the performance and the washout, can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, the information we got, you know, obviously we had record storm surge, right? And this is, you know, over the past, I would say, 3, 4, 5 years, we've seen, you know, storm surge that we haven't seen before prior to that. And so this is, we're learning as well, right? And so there was some washout. I mean, obviously seen the main road washout up in Bradenton Beach. A lot of the washout occurred because of the sand. The sand is pushing our equipment. I mean, you know, it pushed the pads as well. I mean, it uprooted a lot of the underground system that we had already put in. That's not a normal thing to occur, right? So even if we, you know, I know we're putting in elevated pads, and I don't think that would have helped the situation at all because of the sand. It was just very powerful. I mean, you've seen structures being shifted and moved altogether.
So we did have some of that, but I would say over the grand scheme of our underground system, it was a very small percentage of what got washed out.
Do you think that's going to be a problem going forward? Because obviously, this is a 100-year storm, they keep saying, but that doesn't preclude the possibility that next year we're going to have the same problem. And I know Brandon Beach is continuing to pursue more undergrounding to try and get the whole island, our whole city done, you know, funding being the biggest issue because we have to fund it. But, you know, then there's a concern that we fund all this and then we continue to have washouts. So is FPNL addressing that issue? Because we all are barrier islands, you know, Holmes Beach, so forth.
Yeah, we don't necessarily have a solution for the storm surge with the sand pushing in, right? I don't think anybody would have a solution for that at the moment. But we are looking at that and taking into account with the new projects that are coming in, right into beach moving forward. You know, we are looking at elevated pads as we're doing in Lombo Key, and seeing how that would help the situation. But again, with the storm surge that we had, not very many underground systems are going to be able to withstand that, right? So, but you know, the restoration of it, you know, we try to get out there as quickly as possible. The sand and the roads that got washed away was a big hurdle in trying to get back out there. But again, we are looking at that and see what we can do about it.
Yeah, Debbie, it may be helpful for your public works people to talk to Charlie Mops, who is our public works director on these. We just discussed at Tuesday's meeting that we're going to have the ability to raise those transformers in a storm surge. We just approved the budget. Now we just have to get them installed because nothing is going to prepare us for 8, 10, 12-foot storm surge unless we go back to an underground system with something sitting way up in the sky. So being able to elevate those as a storm is approaching may be some assistance. Debbie?
Yep, and the only thing that I wanted to share too, I thought this storm season was really unique in that I know Commissioner Bishop has heard us say it before, but as much as we would love for there to be some kind of silver bullet that exists that will ensure that there is a storm-proof system, we have seen time and time again that Mother Nature is Mother Nature. And with this storm season specifically, we saw a freshwater flood with Debbie. We saw saltwater flood and the sand with Helene, both of which our overhead performed better. We still are getting the data and everything, but visually you could see, well, overhead is up. But then you get Milton, which was a windstorm and destroyed visually what you could see was overhead, right? So I think this storm season you saw that depending on what the storm is, our grid is going to be impacted. The work that we do and the day-to-day learning and every storm season, the data that we get back, what we're trying to do is improve it, not so that necessarily it is a storm-proof system, but so that we can restore faster. In the 2004-05 season, when we got hit with all of those storms that were both wind and water events, it took weeks for us to be able to get our customers back up and running. And I think our time was, I think, up to 5 days. For Milton was the longest one. For Helene and Debbie, we were at like 3 days for 99% of customers to be restored. So while we can't tell you that there'll never be an outage, what we can tell you is all the improvements that we continue to make help us restore that power faster. And that's what our end goal is always going to be, because we know that there is no silver bullet, and we can't predict. I don't think anybody could have predicted the mounds of sand that we saw with Helene. So that's the only other thing that I'll say on storm proving a system.
Jen?
Just two questions. You just touched on a couple of challenges with undergrounding. Are there any others that municipalities or neighborhoods should be considering when they're thinking about weighing their option of funding something like this, aside from the washout that occurs with storm surge and having to potentially have elevated pads for the transformers? Are there anything else that they should consider as a negative?
Yeah, there's... one of the things I can think of is environmental permitting. You know, depending on what area it's in, may require special permits On some of our projects, it's required Army Corps of Engineer permits, which take time to permit. The easement acquisition piece of it is always very challenging. Through the SSUP program, FPL will, handle that side of things, but through the municipal conversion program, you all would have to bear that, that responsibility. That's always a challenge, right? Because we have not only our transformers, but also switchgear. And for the most part, property owners don't want this on their property, but to be able to install an underground system, we have to place them somewhere. So that's always a big challenge moving forward. So, and then there are some cities that, the right-of-ways are very, very narrow. Just working construction-wise is very difficult. Lot lines are sometimes very close to each, property owners have very small lot lines as far as the frontage of their property goes. So they're, unwilling to give up property for the equipment itself. So those are some of the challenges. I'm not sure if the team has any others that they ran into, but again, we can, if any of the municipalities are interested, we can have a sit down discussion and kind of talk through, the process, what's involved, what their responsibilities are, and talk about challenges as well.
Okay. And then ballpark estimates for cost. I'm not going to hold anybody to this number. I estimated from the information that I got from Longboki about $1 million a mile. Is that what it is? Do you have a ballpark?
It's pretty close. It's shifted over the years, but it also depends on, how many customers there are, what kind of equipment we have in that area, if the feeder has been hardened or not. And that's one thing I want to make sure to mention as well. One of the differences between SSUP and the undergrounding program is SSUP does not underground the main feeder lines, which is the backbone, right? So if you drive down, Gulf of Mexico Drive here, you'll see there's sections where we've removed that overhead feeder and then sections that we haven't yet. And so the difference there is our program will remove the overhead feeder. But SSUP, you will still see the main feeder line, but all the laterals coming off of it will be undergrounded.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Other questions on this issue? Terry?
Just one short question.
Would you turn your mic on?
Is it on?
There we go. Yeah.
I'll just get closer. Is it an individual property owner's discretion if a city, municipality decides to go forward with it? The study is conducted, it's funded. The city, under the municipal approach, is responsible for obtaining the easements. But is that an individual property owner, or does the entire city, in order to go forward, does the entire city, every household, every dwelling, have to be a part of it before it's initiated?
So as far as the easement acquisition piece of it, right, the process is you request a ballpark estimate, we provide that, an engineering deposit is paid based off of that estimate, and we will do a preliminary design with placing our equipment. That will be provided to the towns and cities, and, that's where you would go and approach those property owners to try to get those easements. There's a lot of coordination between FPL and the city. If we can shift, if there's an issue with a property owner, we can shift that equipment to possibly the next lot line or something like that. We can work through those issues. But for the most part, all the projects that I've worked on, we've been successful in obtaining the necessary easements and working through those type of issues to move the projects forward. So I think as far as the conversions of the meters go, yes, the property owner and the city have to negotiate that and make sure that they're on board. But as far as like the easements go, it's not going to be every property owner, right? It's going to be certain ones where the equipment is designed.
Not have to be unanimous then with every property owner.
I think maybe BJ could answer that a little bit better with it.
Devin.
I was just going to say, easements, and I think I can speak on behalf of SSUP as well, easements is probably one of the trickiest. And talking about that list of getting bumped up, bumped down, there's some that get skipped over because once our team goes out and starts doing, walking through and talking through with all the residents, there will be an entire street of customers and two of them refuse to give an easement. that we can't move forward with a project and we have to move on to the next one. And so easements does tend to be one of the most difficult, and you'd be surprised, it's not just residents. There are several business owners, even like larger clients that maybe, and this is tends to be a bigger issue with the Barrier Islands, you have a lot of snowbirds and you have a lot of people who own property that are not here, and getting in touch with those people and trying to get easements from those people tends to make things a little bit more difficult as well.
I can tell you, Terry, that we were successful, but it was, in some cases, a grinding process, and you would probably want your legal counsel to talk with Maggie Moody, who is our town attorney, on just how wonderful that experience was. But I think we were 100% successful. And then again, one of the dicier things was when we were going underground, the mobile home park, in terms of physically getting that project through there, because they're quite close together, and that was, Stephen, would you say dicey in terms of how we got the undergrounding completed in the mobile home parks?
The mobile home parks is a little bit different animal, just because of the there's not individual property owners, right? I mean, everybody that's in the mobile home park owns, you know,
the place,
a percentage of the entire lot. So they had to, you know, we're just working through that process. And as you all know, mobile home parks is just very tight in between mobile homes. But we were able to meet with the mobile home parks and kind of discuss it with them, come up with a plan, and get the project to move through. So as you see, the Gulf Shore and Twin Shores up in, just north of here, we worked with them pretty closely, and added some elevated pads just because they were very, forward with the information as far as king tides and water levels and things like that. So we were at the front of that piece of it and working through. And so they've been a very good partner in finally getting the project through those mobile home parks.
All right. Any other questions on moving underground? All right. Let's move on to, Devaney has already read the email.
I'm going to go ahead and just call you up.
Yeah. David?
I was going to say, if there's no more storm related, I know that there are some operations moving forward past storm and where we are with FPL that we want some questions answered for, and this is our guy for you.
So, Stephen, I'm sure that Devaney has already given you the lovely email that I got early this morning from one contractor. I can't even get my house torn down because while we have submitted the request, mine is a little trickier than most because I'm fortunate that I have a garage that's a separate structure with the apartment over top that I'm living in. But we have a number of other, and part of the problem was you all had some people retire that when we were calling the system and saying, hey, please disconnect, blah, 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 nothing was happening. So bring us up to date on where we are there.
So with our disconnects, the disconnect thing, with take service, is what we call it, take service, like a demo. A customer would need to call into customer service, and that's what they request. They don't request a disconnect or a reconnect. They just request a take service. And what that does in the background, it also stops the billing. It takes their name off the account completely. And then that generates a work request for us to go out there and literally remove the meter. And if it's an underground service, we'll disconnect it at the underground pad mount transformer. And if it's an overhead service, we remove the service, completely remove the service.
I think all the service is underground already on LBK. Are we correct there? I don't think there's any.
I don't think so either. So I'd have to go, but most of the time that's right. We'd go out there and we just disconnect to that service. And then the homeowner, whoever's demoing the house, is safe at that point and can demo the house. You know, we are delayed on it. I mean, behind, I say delayed, we've got backlog. I'm trying to get all our backlogs done by the end of the month.
Tell me how backlogged you are.
It varies as they come in. Like I said, when I last looked in this area, there's about 20 on the island up here, and I had 20 down in Sarasota. So I am putting on additional crews to try to get that work done. Unfortunately, this week has, with the weather, has slowed us down even a little bit more. But my plan is to try to, I'm working at those numbers every week now. Because I do know since Helene, like I said, my house alone was damaged in Helene. Fortunately, I get to live upstairs and I don't have to relocate or demo it, but I'm going through the process of having 2 foot of water downstairs. So I know a lot of frustrations there with people going on. So I'm trying to avoid that. So yes, I am looking at that to make sure we're getting all those disconnect services done.
Okay.
I do have your list, and I will follow up with Dev on that list to make sure those are getting done.
So I need to tell all those unhappy contractors when they call the FPL main number, they then say, we need to take service.
Correct.
And that will get a real live person on the phone?
If you get a live person to do it, yes, you will, because that's what you're trying to do, because you have to talk to somebody to get the name off the account. Sometimes what we're seeing run into is when they're calling, they're asking for a disconnect, reconnect, and that's when they're driven to the portal to try to set it up. In that case, we would go out there, we would disconnect in the morning, and then come back in the afternoon and reconnect once the permit, once the inspection was done, if it wasn't a demo.
Okay. So for those who are like you and I, that we still get to live there, even though in something else, after I take service, can I then at the same time say, and rehook service on the new structure? Or on the
yours have to look into, I think that's part of this now, you'd be almost a disconnect, reconnect, because if you have a new service built on the home, we could actually swing it over, hopefully. I don't know if your apartment is underground already as well. I'd have to look. And you might have two meters. You might have 2 meters on your, you might have a meter for the apartment, and you may have a meter also for your residence.
We don't now,
okay.
But we need to.
Okay.
I mean, obviously the meter has to come off the property to be bulldozed, and then we need a new meter to be installed.
So your case will be a different, and it would be a disconnect, reconnect, almost an appointment we'll set up.
Okay.
And we'll have to get with your electrician. Your electrician will have to build the new service.
I think they've done that already.
Okay. And that's a separate thing. But I know a lot of elevated calls that I am getting is just on the take service process.
Yeah.
We see a lot of in the mobile home parks on the beach. I know a lot of those are getting demoed. So we'll go out there and take as many as we can that are in our system. And then, then of course, other residents start calling and want the same thing. It'd be nice to go in there and get everybody at one time, but it's just how the phone calls, come in.
Okay. Anybody else have any issues with tear down?
Nope.
Okay. And then, Devonie, this may be more for you. So as we've talked about the whole undergrounding process and FPL doing some for some communities that are not writing a big check. Is there some compensation for communities that have paid to underground their whole community when you all are now looking at doing undergrounding for other communities that may not be paying for it?
No, so I can specifically talk to the Town of Longboat Key situation, because you all had started that process before SSUP had ever gotten approved by the Public Service Commission. That had already been talked through and finances settled through your previous town management. So that's already been done. And moving forward, that's not the case because of all the programs that are already in place. And it is, the cost that's understood and taken upfront. The town had already started engineering deposits and had been well underway with the program before we ever went to the Public Service Commission with the broader SSUP program.
So would I tell Longboat Key residents that if Northport or Venice or Holmes Beach gets some undergrounding done, that they're paying for that in their bills?
It is part of a clause that is on all bills across the territory. So every single customer, because again, while you're seeing it from the Longboat Key perspective and the customer is being fed off of Longboat Key, the grid is all interconnected.
Gotcha.
And actually you experience this when something failed on the mainland and power went out on the island, right? So undergrounding as a whole benefits the system as a whole and every customer as a whole, because it's all interconnected.
Gotcha.
And so if one thing goes down, it can be a trickle effect. And a perfect example of that is during storm season. And so Commissioner Pechota or Mayor Pechota, the way you had asked about trying to understand that restoration process. When a storm comes through, the first thing we do is send out patrols. And so our critical infrastructure list, our list that we work directly with county staff on, because we work with their EOC, to essentially establish what is considered critical infrastructure to the county. So this is water treatment plants, jails, 911 centers, the hospitals, and things of the like. And so immediately following a storm, our team has a plan in place to go directly down the feeders, because majority of those are fed directly off of a feeder, and they patrol. Once a feeder gets turned on, if there is no damage between the main backbone line and a lateral, that's when you'll start seeing neighborhoods come online. So we follow a process of, we look at first those transmission lines, excuse me, and make sure that everything coming out of the power plant is fine. And if the main lines coming out of the power plant are fine, then we go to the substation level and we patrol the lines coming out of those substations, and those are your main feeders and those are your main thoroughfares. Once we get those back up and running, anything fed off that's not damaged will automatically turn on as soon as that main backbone is on. And then from there, the team narrows it down further and looks at what laterals are feeding the most amount of customers to try and get the most amount of customers back online as fast as possible. So that's kind of the process. And so that goes back to the comment about the SSUP program that is being paid for by all customers, right? Because at the end of the day, being able to flip a switch and everything come online after that, it is, again, operationally, it's the streamlining that we're trying to get to. And so it's going to benefit all customers as a whole.
So probably for the barrier islands, and I would guess that all of our barrier islands, because for us, St. Armand's was flooded, mm-hmm. plus we had 5 feet of sand up and down the road, and Holmes Beach had some issues, I think, with one of the bridges. But all of us are still at the mercy of those laterals and feeds that come from the mainland. So even though everything on all of the islands may be underground, we don't have power stations out on the barrier islands.
That is correct. Okay. And it's the same as, for example, the water that gets fed out to the islands. And I'm at the EOC, so I'm on those calls, and I hear the stress when the county's trying to make a decision on whether or not they're going to shut off power and what that looks like. And that was also why there was such a coordination effort following the storm on restoration, because our team, as you saw with all the trucks and everything, our team was ready to roll out as soon as we were able to do so. Because of the damage and everything that happened, specifically in Lake Bradenton Beach, we were turned away. Our crews were turned away because there was just too much damage. They were still trying to get their arms around what had happened. DOT was coming in and shutting things down. And we had a lot of coordination with fire because water had not been turned back on. And there was the fear of us turning on our equipment and fires possibly starting, and there not being water on the island to put out the fires. And so there was a massive coordination effort. And so again, it's all tied together in some way or fashion. But yes, so to answer your question simply, everything fed on the barrier islands, and Stephen can speak to it better, I don't believe we have any substations out on the barrier islands. Everything is on the mainland. Yeah. And specifically with what had happened in Longboat Key, what's interesting is, and you can speak to this better, it's some of the substations, whether or not those lines are coming from under a bridge versus underwater.
Yeah,
and if there's damage.
And we had a bridge in Sarasota that got hit by a boat, so that took us out as well.
Exactly.
Jen has a question.
I know you all have a lot of information on your website, and you do a lot of outreach during the hurricanes and situations. Some folks aren't able to go online, and so on and so forth, so that can be a little bit challenging. Do you have any printed material that we could, as a municipality, have available that explains the pre-hurricane and post-hurricane process that you all go through, so that we can maybe convey that to our constituents?
Absolutely. Another part that I find that it becomes very important post-storm is understanding what is customer-owned versus what is FPL-owned. Mm-hmm. It tends to become a hot spot following storm. We typically see trends on and we monitor it through social media, of like when specific questions start coming up, around what day, when we know our customer base starts kind of losing patience and grace, the grace period, and when that's over. One of the really big trends that we see is usually around day three, day four, when people are starting to, they're able to evaluate damage, is calling us, telling us that there's an FPL issue, our crew goes out, and it's something that needs to be handled by the customer and an electrician, because it's customer-owned equipment and not FPL-owned equipment. And so that is an important piece of information that I'm happy to share. We have, and please send, ask your staff to contact me, and I can send them links to all the PDFs that are available that you all are able to print. Excuse me, that are, you are able to print. I try to attend every Hurricane Expo in the area as well to try to have that material readily available. And then and I know that there's always a lack of, possibly a lack of internet and service following a storm, but we do put everything that we can on through our social channels as well as our Facebook, our apps. And then we work very closely at the EOC, getting information out through the EOC, through the county websites as well.
Thank you very much. I would really appreciate that. And I just while I have you here, I wanted to say that during Helene or Milton, one of the two, mm-hmm. I think it was, well, they were so close together, probably Milton. Old neighborhood that I live in, so just anecdotally, somebody from FPNL came out. We had, there was like a live
wire,
and then one drooping very low, and it was a personal property issue because of the attachment of where it was. Anyway, without going into the detail, FPL came out, and a gentleman, and I think I wrote his name down, realized that it was just generally everybody was afraid and frustrated and helped. And he just, on his own, he was there to do something completely different, took it upon himself to help. And so kudos to him, and I can't remember his name, but I think I did write it down. But, you know, the people that we dealt with, that I dealt with personally, just really went above and beyond. Yeah. So, you know, the crew, the staff, the people that come and help, I just couldn't say enough good things about them, so...
I appreciate that. We'll be sure.
I know you get a lot of flack, but you should also know that the people that you hire that I've come in contact with have been really great.
Yeah. And Devaney, what you all did last summer when Debbie was not causing as much pressure on you and your CEO was here and invited a group of us out to the fairgrounds to actually do that whole walkthrough of how they coordinate during a hurricane was so helpful, and I hope we have a really minor storm again that we could get the Manasota Lake there as a group, because it's unbelievable what you guys put together. Literally, oh, storm's coming, we need to feed people, we need to house people, and oh, by the way, we need to restore power to seven cities and a bunch of islands. And it was really, really helpful and very illuminating to see what you guys put together. And one of the most amazing things is I was pulling out of the parking lot, and there was this lovely gentleman there who was directing traffic, and I had the mayor with me, and he said, oh, and what area do you work in? And I think he said that he was an accountant. Literally, yep. Everybody at FPL gets a really special job during hurricane season, and a lot of it is just directing trucks, but it was truly amazing, and thank all of you, because I know when hurricanes are coming, it means you leave your families, and a lot of cases, like Stephen, you leave your families and your house is flooding, and you have all of the nightmares that we have without having to say, bye, honey. We'll be back in 3 or 4 weeks. So thank all of you. It is really a remarkable effort.
Thank you. And I will say, yes, we all have what we call a storm roll as well as a blue sky roll. So normal day to day, what we normally do. But during dark sky rolls, you will see lawyers helping with laundry. You'll see accountants helping with parking. We all get spread out. It is a full force effort. And I want to extend the invitation. Obviously, we are all hoping that there are no more storms and that we are bypassed this year and hopefully for years to come. But when a storm comes, post-storm, if any of you are interested in seeing what that operation looks like, I'm more than happy to schedule that and take you guys out to see it. It is a point of pride personally for me, but it is incredible to see an entire city pop up in less than 24 hours. And I know Commissioner Bishop had seen it, but I mean, we have to think through everything, bathrooms, showers, sleepers, laundry, making sure that these folks are fed all day and are literally working 16 hours, coming back just to sleep for the 8, wake up and do it all again. And so it's a big lift. I am happy to say that we are the best in the industry, but that's also because we've had the most practice to perfect it. But there are always lessons learned. So every single storm season, we find a way to improve. We train all year round. We have a dry run that's usually right before storm season. And it is a fake storm that we drill through. I have said multiple times that we don't need any more practice, that they can send the fake storm to the East Coast for practice. But yes, anytime you guys want more insight on how that works, you can contact me as well.
Fabulous. Devaney, will you be sure that you leave cards with Gail?
Yep.
And Stephen, you as well, so everybody knows who to reach out to? All right. Thank you so much.
Any other questions?
Thank you. All right. Moving on, we did the minutes. So we're moving right on to the election of officers. And I'm going to start at the bottom of the list because it's easier. Brian Williams is currently serving as treasurer. He is not with us today. He is home with the bug that seems to be going everywhere. I had it for 3 weeks and was praying for death. So I would like to nominate Brian. I believe this is his last full year that he will be serving, but I would like to nominate Brian to continue as treasurer. Is there other nominations? There's a second from Terry.
Right.
Other nominations?
No.
Hearing none, just a voice of acclamation. All those in favor of Brian Williams returning as treasurer signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. And Brian Williams will return as treasurer. Vice President, we need a nomination, please.
I would like to nominate Lisa Gonzalez-Moore.
All right, we have Lisa Gonzalez-Moore.
Didn't ask her if she's okay with that nomination, though.
You'll do that.
I am delighted.
I am honored.
We have a second.
Second. Debbie.
Debbie seconded. Are there other nominations? Hearing none, we'll call for another vote of acclamation. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And we have the third position nomination, please, for the office of president.
I'd like to nominate BJ Bishop.
Great, thanks.
didn't ask.
A quick second.
Are there other nominations? Hearing none, a third voice of acclamation. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. Now we will move on to the president's report, which basically is, I have been totally overloaded, and we are moving forward not nearly as fast as Gail would like to find a new administrative manager or whatever we're calling the position. I would like to thank both Terry and Steve who could Charles Salem, who could not be here today due to a conflict with a special meeting in his municipality, but I believe you all received a copy of the redone job description.
Right.
Yes,
and Terry, thank both of you so much.
Sure.
Because it would still be sitting in the bottom of my pile. And thanks to Stephanie, she took the job description and put together an ad for the Florida League of Cities website and the Clerks Association. And thanks to Nick, who I was able to send one person to for interviews, and I think so far that's the only one we have gotten. Gail, have you gotten anything else from FLC or the Clerks Association? All right. Well, if we are not successful in the next few weeks of having additional nominees, we have several opportunities. Before this position became a job that was handled through the town of Longboat Key for the part-time position and the meetings held here, it was rotated through the various municipalities. And the last municipality that had it was Sarasota before the role came out here, and their town clerk handled the role of the Minnesota League, and the meetings, I believe, were held in Sarasota. And so if all of you would reach out in your community, and quite honestly, I don't expect the Barrier Islands probably to be in a role to be ready to say, oh yeah, and we'll put this on the clerks and you all come to our town. Because they've got an awful lot on their plates, especially Bradenton Beach. But if not, see if that is a possibility or even something that any of your municipalities would consider. And we can talk about that at our, we may have to talk about that via email. Nick, what do you think would be a reasonable time frame interview-wise, and if we don't have other candidates coming forward?
So, excuse me. So I think that we get it posted through FLC and such and give it 2 weeks and then start the interview process with what we have, which we know we have at least one candidate right now. So then I say within that time frame, we should bring somebody back by the next meeting, a name by the next meeting.
Okay. So let's, why don't you and I talk with Gail in 2 weeks?
Yep.
And then we'll go from there, if that's acceptable with everyone.
Yes.
Yep. Yes, yes, good. All right. Lisa, I'm sure you have an extensive vice president's report.
I don't know that I do. I think I did email, though, that I'm not totally positive. I want to confirm. I may have emailed, but I think I have a conflict now with our the next trip. Did I email that? Were you guys aware?
Oh, the next trip, the DC trip?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I know we had allotted some funds and whatnot, but I wanted to let you all know as soon as possible for the purposes of allocating the funds.
That just means more money for the rest
of
us.
That is what I was hoping. I'm very sorry to miss it because I'm excited for another opportunity. And I intend to calendar more in advance so I can avoid conflicts. But it's time, no, I do not, but I'm very appreciative of you all putting your confidence in me in the role, and I'm looking forward to it.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Treasurer's report, and actually, Gail, I'm just going to, yes, you may.
I'm meeting the city hall. I have to leave for, so excuse
me. Oh,
excuse
absolutely. Okay. Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
I'll see you all next time.
All right. Gail, why don't you come up and do the treasurer's report and your report all at the same time?
See you later.
Okay, Brian Williams did send the treasurer's report.
Yep.
This is for the statement November 30th through December.
Gail, can you pull your microphone closer?
Yes.
To be sure it's on.
Okay, so Brian Williams submitted the treasurer's report. This is for November 30th through December 31st, 2024, where the account value now is $83,383.07. The withdrawals for that period was $1,108.71. The beginning value with this period was $82,123.39. Assets added $2,038. Change in value $30.39. So it's $83,383.07 is what's in the account at the moment. And he does, if you see the second page, he does move money from one account to the other where you get the most interest.
Okay.
So that would be the money market account. And then the $30,000 you see coming out was what it was moved over to the other account. We paid $954.89 to the Florida League of Cities, and that was for the breakfast meetings. And
that was for the breakfast.
Yes, it's
yeah, I'm not used to doing this. And $153.82, that was made to me because when we had the meeting for the people running for office, we had to pay taxes on it. And normally we thought we were tax exempt, but I guess not. So that was part of this $153.82. And then I had paid, because we didn't have checks there, $91 and something it was change. So that's what the check's written to me for. And then the money market account for 42 days, deposits $318.09. And that's one thing Minnesota League does not have is a credit card. And never had one, never applied for one. So that's why everything's done by checks. Even when we get associate members who are interested, which I've had a couple people contact me lately saying they were interested, various companies. But we have to be careful with who we're getting because some of them might, well, this is what Brian said. Some of them are just looking for to be able to come in and just give their spiel for whatever they're selling. So I always verify when we get an email that says they're interested. I always go and look and see if that company's real and if that person is really working for that company to make sure, you know, that it's all okay. And to be an associate member, I can remember how much now, which we used to have a lot of them. We have the airport, still have the airport, Sarasota Bradenton Airport is an associate member. Florida Power is an associate member. I didn't bring my whole list here, but,
why don't you just send us the list of associate members and that would probably be a good discussion for the next meeting on the criteria for associates and we can move on.
Right. Okay. We used to have a lot of associate members, but they kind of dropped off, you know, during COVID and so forth like that. So, I mean, we can work to get some more. And we have a form they fill out. And they have to submit a check for $250 and come before the board and get approved. So we haven't done that for a while.
I think Jen has a question.
This may be a silly question, but I have the two sheets of paper here and it says 1 of 4 and 2 of 4. Am I supposed to have a 3 of 4 and a 4 of 4?
I think that was just... No, I only got two from Brian.
I just didn't know.
But I think that one was just the... wasn't to do with the money.
The boilerplate from Edward Jones?
Okay.
It was just due for the money.
All right. And your report, please.
Okay. Well, our next meeting, we are supposed to have the president of Florida League of Cities here. Name's Mayor Michael Blake. He's from City of Cocoa. He's has a 2024 to 2025 term for Florida League of Cities to be their president. The next meeting is March 13th, and that's when he'll be there, be here to...
Hold up. Jen has a question on those dates, too, because
yeah,
I know there's a conflict.
There's an NLC conference that I will be attending, so I'm not so sure.
Yeah, the National League of Cities Legislative Conference is in D.C. that on the 12th and 13th of March in D.C. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that Michael's... not going to be at that conference.
Yeah, me either.
Well, unless something changed, that's what I was given by...
All right, well, we're, you need to, A, this, we may not have a quorum, depending on how many people are attending the legislative conference, and you also need to check, this is one of the things that so annoys me, that the right hand and the left hand do not always seem to be working at the Florida League of Cities, that we need to be, obviously, the president of the Florida League of Cities needs to be an NLC. So if that's the case, we're going to need to look. You said...
It could be May.
No, no, no. Wait a minute. You said...
March.
Our meeting was March...
13th.
Okay. We may need to move to the week after, but you'll need to confirm if my... if the league president is available, and then also see if we have a quorum that's available.
Okay.
So if you would confirm both of those things, that would be useful.
Okay, like
20th.
Okay, I can do the 20th. Can all of you look at your calendars and see if March 20th is possible?
Mm-hmm. I'm good. You guys good?
Anybody not good?
Checking still. You guys are much quicker than I am.
We're really fast with these social things.
I have the bike ride with the mayor in Venice. So
you have a what?
Bike ride with the mayor. We do a, it's a program we do in Venice for bike month or whatever. So I won't be able to be here. I'm going to be biking around Venice with our residents.
That sounds just fabulous. I should...
It's actually great. We have a lot of fun with it. We do like a little historical tour and a lot of fun. But oh. March 20th, I'll be doing that. And
how about March 27th?
And we have to, Stephanie can check if the...
Florida League of Cities Legislative Action available. Days.
Yeah, no. Tallahassee.
Oh, that's right. None of us will be here on the 27th. March 6th.
Your meeting in Tallahassee.
Huh? Yeah, well, we should all meet in Tallahassee. March 6th.
That's the FLC leadership meeting.
Oh, that's right. Okay. So, Nick, we'll have to hear from you if we can't
it's
do
okay.
it. Yeah. All right.
We can do without one of us here. It's okay.
Okay.
Well, I have legislative action days being March 24th through the 26th. Is
yes.
That correct? Okay.
I got it on my calendar that maybe we're traveling back on the 27th. I don't know, but it's on my calendar.
We're probably traveling back on the 27th because who drives 6 hours after talking to legislators all day? All right, Gail, please get back to us on the FLC president's schedule, and we'll go from there. But right now, we look like we're going to be March 20th.
I have another question.
Jen has another question.
So we had talked about doing this in Sarasota.
Yes.
I asked the city manager, it looks like it's going to be possible. I would like to get a 100% confirmation that we can do it in the city, but my last conversation was yes.
Okay. So you will need to coordinate with Jen as well on if we can actually do that
in
City Hall in Sarasota.
When is that now? That you're talking about?
The 20th.
March 20th.
Okay.
Demetrius?
If you can excuse me, I have a state of the city. I have to run.
Yes. Okay. Yes, we're good at
I don't know if you guys have any voting.
No, we're just going to do the executive director for the Minnesota League and the Minnesota League member to be considered for District 10, and we've got to be out of here at 11:30. So, yeah, thank you very much. Do we still have a quorum? Yes, we do. Hanging by a thread.
I just want it to be noted that if you are going to do it in Sarasota, the 20th should work according to their, if it works for their schedule, but we have a Zoning Board of Adjustment meeting scheduled here that morning.
Okay, so
it may be canceled, but it's on the calendar.
Okay, so we really need Sarasota to be able to have the meeting on the 20th.
I will ask.
Last two.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so you're saying that March 20th is when you want to have it at City of Sarasota?
We have to have it at the City of Sarasota because the BZA is meeting here.
Okay.
So if that doesn't work, we're going to have to really do a lot of calendar dancing. All right, Gail, finish your report fairly quickly so we can get through these two old business and new business issues.
Okay, this is an important one because we're on a deadline. And that would be appointing someone from our board to be considered for the Florida League of Cities Board of Directors meeting representing...
Yep, we have that as new business item 7, so yeah. We will do that.
So basically, that's what we need to know is who we would recommend. We're just recommending it to the Florida League for representing District 10, which is our district, to be considered for the Florida League of Cities Board of Directors. Is there a nomination?
You don't do that. We do that from up here when we get to new business.
Okay.
All right. Anything else from your report?
Florida League of Cities starts planning for their conference really early. So I know that it's going to pop up any day now wanting to know if we're going to participate in the breakfast meeting. It's in Orlando this year.
Yeah. Jen?
Yeah.
What is the consensus for those of us who have spent $90 a person for breakfast?
I just don't get why we can't just go to a Denny's and have breakfast.
I can't either.
So it doesn't make any sense. I've always told the city, I said, I don't want us spending that kind of money. It's just a waste.
It is a waste. It was my first year last year, and I don't know that I feel like the benefit was really there. I mean, you've just spent all that time with all the other leagues, so
exactly.
You could make that opportunity.
Yep.
I agree.
I move that we do not participate in the breakfast meeting at the annual conference in August. Do I have a second?
Second.
Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And that will move forward 5-0-3. Nick?
One suggestion I would have on it is perhaps we can reach out to the representative at the league and suggest a different mechanism for this. Because, I mean, we do get to meet each other. It doesn't take an act of Congress to get everybody together. A cup of coffee would be much more rational.
Quite honestly, we could say the Minnesota League would like to meet with all of you and the, you know, we always have
couch
that
couch over there.
Right.
We always have that coffee hour for an hour in the morning and
absolutely.
Just say, the Minnesota League would like to see everybody at coffee hour with the other leagues.
I think we could even host a coffee hour for
a lot less than $90.
I'll brew the
person.
Coffee.
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
So that's a no?
No.
No.
Okay.
That's a hard no.
Yeah.
All right. Let me see what else I have here. So the registration's open now for the Florida Legislative Action Day.
Actually, it's been open for several weeks, and the hotels are filling quickly. We didn't even get it. I literally registered on day one and ended up at not the main hotel. So if you're going...
What's that for?
Huh?
Tallahassee
for Legislative Days.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's really good. You should really...
Oh, I want to go. I just didn't realize that the hotels are already...
It's a short session, so every lobbyist in the state is hanging out in Tallahassee.
Wow. You going?
I am. Yeah, we usually go with a decent size, our administration and myself. I try to get other council members to go, but I definitely go every year. Very rewarding. You don't have to necessarily follow the league's program. You can do your own thing. But what the league does is they provide us a lot of very good material to take when we go have our meetings so that we can have some discussions about what's happening here at home, but also what's happening in the league's priorities. Very beneficial. And don't let the hotel thing dissuade you. I mean, there's hotels.
There's
you'll just have to
hotels.
Travel. you'll have to, you might have to drive, you know, 20 minutes or something, but yeah.
We find it easier just to park the car in Uber.
Yeah. But it's 100% if you've never been, I would definitely go.
So is there a way, because I have never gone, because I would be like a fish out of water, right? So
you are more than welcome to reach out to me when you're heading up, and I will take you under the wing and show you everything.
I don't even know where to go.
Okay, we will probably...
The league does everything, yeah.
And Jeb and I will probably have one more seat because Penny and I are going, Jen's coin. We'll have one more seat because I'm usually the chauffeur.
Well, I'm flying up.
Oh, that's right. Jen's flying up. So we have two seats. So just call me, Deb, and
okay.
We'll coordinate.
That'd be awesome.
Okay.
And at the executive directors meeting we just had a couple weeks ago that I participated in.
We can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. the executive directors meetings that we have once a month, which that's what I'm called as well, but different name. They said they want it kind of done differently this year. They would like for people that are going to, first of all, if you're going to be chauffeured around, I guess you say, shifted around by your lobbyists. That's different, but they said some people are bringing in, what do they call it? They're going to assign a person to each group, Florida League is. Like the people to stay with them, the one, if that's who you're assigned to. And you know, if you want to talk about your city's priorities and so forth like that, you'd have to... you know, and go with your lobbyist. You'd have to make the appointments. It's gotten very complicated this
year. We've always done that. Gail, and quite honestly, I would leave it to the individual cities in terms of their meetings. We have been doing that ourselves for years.
Yeah.
And then the league schedules meetings, and we've always had a league staffer that goes with us to those cattle calls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, they are having a woman from one of the other leagues this year kind of handle who wants to go. And if you want her to make the appointments or your own lobbyists make them or whatever, she would like to know that. So I don't know if anybody's interested in having her make your appointments or...
Well, they make the appointments as scheduled with the league staffers. With our individual appointments, what they sent to us was... You are not to discuss your town issues at the league scheduled conferences, so we'll take care of that.
That's okay, good.
Not on our plates.
All right, good. So I think we're saying no to the breakfast meetings and the conference in Orlando. I guess that's all.
Okay.
That I have for now.
All right. Old business, I think we've pretty much covered the administrative coordinator, where we are with all of that. New business, we need an appointment of a Minnesota League of Cities board member to be considered for the Florida League of Cities Board of Directors representing District 10.
Chair, I'd love to volunteer for that.
I move that we nominate Nick Pachota. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any other nominations? Bless you, Nick.
Thank you.
We will call for those in favor.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. Nick Pachota will be the name sent forward to the Florida League of Cities as our District 10 board representative.
If I could add to that for a moment. I always get the paperwork for that, so I will put your name in there and get it off to them like we need. So,
all right. Is there any other business to come before this body? Thank you, guys. I know it was a lot of information for one meeting, but thank you all so much. And we are adjourned at 11:16. Nick, congratulations on running.
Thank